This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The city of Gary has a new mayor. Michael Puente, the host of Off Mic, recently spoke with Mayor Jerome Prince here in our studio about his plans for the city, as well as how he plans to transform the city of Gary back into the Magic City. And here's the conversation.
Well, it's been a really busy 2 weeks for our first guest. Since being sworn in as Gary's new mayor, Jerome Prince has called for the demolition of 10 vacant schools in the city. He's traveled to Indianapolis to meet with lawmakers and attended a groundbreaking ceremony for Gary's new Hard Rock Casino with members of the Jackson Five, I may add. So Mayor Prince joins us in studio right now. Mayor, welcome to Off Mic.
Thank you, Michael.
So let me ask you this. Are you ready to get off the train? Have you had enough already the past couple of weeks?
No, we're just getting started. Actually enjoying ourselves.
So tell me, has the job so far, you've got a lot of momentum right now, but is the job, from your vantage point, is it a little bit bigger than you thought it would be?
I think that's a fair statement. You never really know what you get into until you actually get there. But to be certain, I've had a considerable amount of experience over the last 20 years in several capacities, and so that's prepared me greatly for the challenges ahead.
You know, obviously, you beat Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson back in the primary, and sort of the political structure, way it's set up here in Northwest Indiana, you didn't have much of a general election challenger. How has it been to wait this whole time to actually get in office to start doing things?
That's been the toughest part, to be honest with you. Yeah, because obviously there's a lot to do and a lot to engage in City of Gary, but we've just been really eager to do so. And I'd like to fashion it as the longest transition in history, if you will.
Right.
But glad to be here now.
Do you have a plan sort of for your first 90 days in office, what you hope to accomplish in that time?
We do, Michael. We certainly want to address the issues that we've talked about all during the campaign, and certainly address the promises that we've made. And those would include securing our finances, absolutely getting a grip on public safety, and to address the aesthetics of the city, if you will.
Yes, right. And you're talking about public safety. One of the very first things you did coming into office was calling for the school city of Gary to demolish 10 vacant schools in the city. What's the point of doing that?
Well, thank you for that question. Very simply, from day one, since we've entered this race, public safety has always been the number one priority from our perspective. We want to make sure that we have a safe city. And so to this point, those establishments were formerly places where we educated our children. And for the last 10 years or so, they've become layers of crime and just certainly not conducive to the quality of life that our residents deserve.
You know, people are going to say, well, we don't have the money. It takes a lot of money to demolish these buildings. Are you sort of done with the excuses? Are you ready to say, hey, look, we got to do something to get rid of these buildings, because not only are they an eyesore, they're dangerous to the public?
Well, I think the fact that we've chosen to use the UBL, the unsafe building law, suggests that we are done with excuses. And from my perspective, there's never a really good excuse when the community is affected by situations like that, and particularly they lead to lapses in public safety.
You know, from my vantage point, covering the city and covering some of the great things happening in the city and the not so great things, it almost feels like you may have to be the mayor of two cities, one where you're trying to generate economic development. You were at the groundbreaking for the new casino in Gary, but you're always having to now deal with hands-on with the number one issue always affecting Gary, which is public safety. There's already been 3 homicides in the city since the start of the new year. How is that affecting you now as the city of mayor, as the mayor of Gary?
Well, it's, you know, something that as a resident of Gary that I've been, I guess, aware of, and certainly citizens deserve better and are demanding more. And so to that perspective, we think that we've made the right decision in selecting Colonel Richard Leegan to lead our police department. And to that extent, we feel like we're in confident hands, and we're just going to continue pressing forward, addressing the issues that are most important to our community. And again, public safety being the number one issue.
Is there any significant or something where the public may see in terms of changes in the way the police deals with the public, and in terms of maybe more cooperation from them, or maybe using calls to generate tips on leads on crime? What is the police department concretely doing to try to address crime?
So that's a question that's probably better answered by Colonel Leegan. And to that extent, I think I made it expressly clear that as an administration, we certainly don't want to tie his hands. From my perspective, I'm going to make sure that he has all the resources, personnel, equipment-wise, to perform to the best of his ability. But to your point, we certainly can expect that we'll have open dialogue with our residents and engage them to get just as involved as we are.
Now, how excited are you about the building of the new Hard Rock Casino in Gary? There was a big groundbreaking ceremony yesterday in the city, a lot of excitement. Gary's had a casino now for more than 20 years. Is this sort of a rebirth of the industry in Gary? What is going to change with this new development?
That's a great analogy. So right off the bat, I believe the estimate is another 500 additional jobs. But equally important, we feel that a development of this magnitude sort of exposes Gary in a different light. If you just consider the hundreds of thousands of people who passed through here along 80-94, that means that other people who come through the city will have something more attractive to look at. And the ultimate desire is that other business entities will decide that if Hard Rock, a major brand such as Hard Rock, has decided to invest their resources in the Gary, that maybe something else is happening there, and maybe it is a good opportunity to take a second look. And so we're extremely excited about it, to say the least.
Are you going to worry at all about the sort of changing market conditions in the Chicago area as it deals with a casino industry? Because already Chicago's supposed to be getting one somewhere. We're not sure where in Chicago, but theoretically, just 20 miles to the west of Gary in Homewood, there could be a casino there, or maybe one in Calumet City. Do you worry about things like that? Competitors, maybe in Matteson, which isn't too far away from Gary. Or is the market just going to have to deal on its own?
So I don't want to dismiss it, but Michael, as you know, I've probably got enough things to worry about, so I'm certainly not trying to invent more. We believe that having a major brand such as Hard Rock and with their partnership with Spectacle, that we're certainly on good footing, and we'll just sort of, as you suggested, let the market kind of take care of itself. I think one of the most attractive things about Hard Rock is that they're more than just a gambling or a betting institution. They actually offer entertainment venues, and we're hoping that that entertainment and the revived interest in the Jackson family being involved with the city of Gary as well as Hard Rock, we're thinking that that combination will bring us the type of attention that we need and be able to sustain the growth of that particular facility.
Now, already this week, you traveled down to Indianapolis to meet with lawmakers. How did that trip go, and what were you asking for?
The trip was excellent. So we went down to check on a couple of legislative initiatives that we are advancing down there to make sure that they have been attached or either attached to another bill, that is, or at least sponsored in the form of legislation. And we're pretty excited about where we're headed with that. As you know, it's a short session. And
right.
So we expect to continue to get positive feedback. We have a legislative call headed for or scheduled for today to get an update, and we'll continue to do that as the session progresses.
How were you received down in Indianapolis? Obviously, Indiana is a very red state. Do you even worry about things like that when you head down there?
I don't. Not at all. And again, I point back to my experience and the work that I've done in the various capacities that I've held. Most recently, as Lake County Assessor, I say that to say, and it's easy for me, you know, to you know, tout my successes in that. But I think that, and I'm certain, based on the responses that we've received downstate, that that's resonated, and the reception was just phenomenal. To be clear.
Now, you know, I've been seeing a lot of, obviously, social media plays a big role in our society now. A lot of comments from non-Gary residents on how they, you know, are looking to your administration with kind of, kind of inquisitive of what's going to happen. You know, what can non-Gary residents do for the city of Gary? I mean, can they play a part in trying to rejuvenize the city?
They absolutely can, and I believe it starts with helping to reshape the narrative of the city. You know, for some time here, there's just been so many negative perceptions and images associated with the city. I believe that people outside of Gary are just excited, if not more, than the people in the city, and I don't think that it's simply because I took office. It's because they've seen the evidence of my work ethic and my integrity and the character as an elected official. And I believe that's what they're excited about. And to that extent, I think we can expect some different ideas and different perspectives moving forward of the city of Gary.
Now, Mayor, what will success mean for your administration? You know, half a year from now, a year from now, 2 years from now, what is a success or turning around the city going to look like under your administration?
It's great, Michael. So to me, success is viewed in a couple of different perspectives. But instead of looking a year out because of the magnitude of the issues that we face, we sort of take it in 90-day increments, if you will. And so in 90 days, we expect that there will be very visible changes that continue to at least increase the attention that the city's getting. The other side of success for me is a personal one, and I liken it to personal success being if I wake up every day and I work as hard as I can and I do my very best to change the image of the city and realize some accomplishments, for me, that's a success.
And if there was like just three goals that you hope to accomplish, I know you're taking it in 90-day increments, but just three things you would like to see changed in the city, improved upon, or implemented, say in the next year, what were the three things would be?
That's a fair question. So I absolutely would like to see a cleaner city, without question. I'd like to see a city that is attractive to investors or people who are interested in economic development opportunities in the city and to realize some of those opportunities. But most of all, I want to see a safe city, one that attracts other persons who would like to call Gary home, such as myself. And to do that, it sort of goes back to our initiative to demolish or eliminate some of the blight, starting with the schools. We absolutely have to make a better environment for the younger people and for our children.
Mayor, I only got a couple of more questions. One of the things, I'm usually driving into Gary pretty much every day because my daughter goes to Indiana University Northwest. Such a great school. How can the city better partner with a university, sort of have maybe a more cohesive relationship, more cooperation? How do you plan to do that?
So I think the city has a decent relationship with the university now, but as you just suggested, that could always be enhanced. One way that we could certainly do that is an initiative that we talked about during the campaign and something that we'll engage in again in discussions with the university, and that is a more cohesive relationship in trying to establish a better or new school system. We believe that our public school system should be directly tied to one of the universities, and certainly with Indiana University being in Gary, we certainly start there. But we wouldn't just limit that sort of exposure to IUN. We have Purdue that's slightly to the west of us, and we believe those type of opportunities are what's going to change our school system. We believe that a combination of those two is what will encourage others to take a second look at Gary and want to educate their children, rather, and make Gary a home.
You know, my last question is, how are you, what's the relationship going to be like? I know a lot of people like to visit Miller Beach, the Miller area of Gary during the summer. There seems to be a lot of nice shops down there already. I know there's some construction work down there, but there seems always to be sort of a sort of animosity or disconnect between Miller and the rest of the city. How is your relationship going to be there with that area of the city?
Well, I'm extremely familiar with Miller, having grown up there for a portion of the time as a child. I've recently relocated to the Miller section of Gary. My wife and I, we bought a home in Miller. We certainly enjoy the benefit of having a huge degree of support out of that community. And so, to your point, I believe that it's extremely important that Miller, we realize any potential benefit there to increase economic development and home ownership out there as well, but that we do it in conjunction with realizing the same type of initiatives or opportunities in the rest of the city. And one area that I particularly think of is the Glen Park area or University Park, as you mentioned. I think that if we create those type of synergies and share equal resources and opportunities all over the city, that that's how you change that narrative or that disconnect that you spoke about.
Well, Jerome Prince is the new mayor of Gary, Indiana. He just took office not even a week and a half ago. Mayor Prince, thank you so much for joining us here on Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Michael, the pleasure is all mine. Thank
you. Good
luck.
Thank you.
That's Michael Puente talking with Mayor Jerome Prince of Gary. Off Mic airs every Friday at 11 o'clock here on Lakeshore Public Radio. The town of Griffith is still on a quest to break away from Calumet Township. Griffith tried unsuccessfully so far to join St. John Township and North Township, and now the town has filed a bill with the legislature on January 9th that would in turn allow it to be able to perform its own township duties. Town Council President Rick Rifa spoke recently about the issue with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson, and here's their conversation.
I wanted to talk to you just about where the town of Griffith is in the process of seceding. Can you tell us about that? I understand that things didn't work out with St. John Township and North Township.
Yeah, we haven't had any luck with St. John Township or North Township. We do still have until November of 2020 to try to get something done. Not sure what will happen in those areas. In the meantime, we have filed a bill that was filed that would allow Griffith to essentially perform township services ourselves. And we would do that whether simply just providing township services as required by law, or we would form our own township to facilitate the services.
So what does the bill say?
It's changed about three times since we submitted the draft. So I think I haven't got a copy of the final bill yet, but it would just allow Griffith under various ways to perform township services, whether through a township or, you know, just through the actual government. So we're still working out the details with some of the committee chairs to try to get it where it's feasible to everybody.
And what are township services?
Our belief is that they provide temporary relief, temporary services for those that had lost income or had some unfortunate circumstances happen in their lives. And other than that, the other one would be to bury the dead who can't pay to bury themselves or have somebody to bury themselves.
And if you could recap why Griffith wants to be out of Calumet Township.
Okay, we've talked about for years just the unfairness of the amount of money that we pay versus any money that even comes back. But the bigger thing is we are subject to a very unfair tax compared to the rest of the township. And it goes to the fact that the tax caps were taking full effect this year, as well as what they have been over the years. We are subject to a very, very high tax rate because the properties in Gary are at a very, very high tax rate simply because the collection rate is 38%. And the collection rate in Gary is 38%, not because people aren't paying their bills. It's because of the tax caps, where there's a lot of just high rates throughout the entire district, whether it be schools, township, city. So they have some of the highest tax rates in the state. So what happens then, Griffith is taxed at that same very high tax rate, but we're paying, our collection rate is 98%. So in effect, in reality is, the city of Gary taxes at an extremely high tax rate, knowing they're only going to get 38% of what they tax, but we're subject to that same very tax, but we're paying it at a 98% clip. So that in itself is more unfair than anything else that we've had to deal with over the years.
So Griffith and Gary get taxed at the same high rate, but you're saying Gary only has to pay 38% of that while Griffith has to pay 98% of it?
Correct. And the word has would kind of might be a stretch to say it's the collection rate by it. There's only so much money that could be paid under the tax caps of 1, 2, and 3%, whereas 1% is residential, 2% would be apartments, 3% would be business. So with Gary having almost all of their property at the tax caps, so if they levy, I'm just assuming, throwing some numbers out there, $30 million, they're only going to get about 38% of that. Whereas if we levy, $5 million, we're getting 98% of what we levy to run our town. So with us being subjected to the same exact rate in Gary as Griffith, as being in the same township, that's where the unfairness is.
So when will you know whether or not this bill is going to pass?
Well, no. The first hurdle is to get it out of the Senate. There will be a House bill filed in the Senate. I believe the deadline is January 29th to pass from the Senate to the House.
And is there anybody sponsoring this bill for you?
Yes. Senator Rick Niemeyer is the individual who had put the bill in.
Anything else you can tell me about the situation and where it is now?
Just we've always maintained we don't have an issue with township government. The issue is we are in such an unfair situation, it is the most unfair one in the state. And we're at the point where we've literally begged St. John Township, we begged North Township to take us. We have no other choice but to have some legislation to help our citizens. And the simple fact that when we had a referendum on this, 3,301 people voted in favor and 70 people voted against, which means 98% of all the people in Griffith that voted to leave Kalima Township. I got to think that I don't care what level of government, when you've got any population that votes 98% in favor of something, got to find a way to try to appease and help the people.
Yeah, but who would suffer if, just saying, playing devil's advocate, who would suffer if Griffith didn't get what it wanted? Would some politician, would it lose an election for someone?
I can't say that, but the people that would suffer would be the taxpayers of Griffith who have continued paying the high rates.
Right, but who would be having to answer for that?
It would have to be the members of the Indiana General Assembly if we can't find a way to get something resolved.
And who's the representative there?
I think Griffith has. I think we've got three representatives in the House. I'm not sure where that's going to go in the House yet. We're working with some other people, but very fortunate that Senator Rick Niemeyer, who's a very strong pro-advocate of townships, has agreed to try to help us to get out of this because he sees the serious issue that property owners are facing.
Mm-hmm. Would the taxpayers of Griffith save money if you guys get out of the township?
Everybody would save money. The property taxpayers, the Griffith Public Schools would get more money because it would lessen the amount of circuit breakers caused by the tax caps. The town of Griffith would receive more revenue because of the effect of the tax caps being lessened. I believe Lake County, the county government, would receive several hundred thousand dollars extra in revenue simply because there would be more to be paid under the Griffith tax bills that wouldn't be subject to the tax caps. So every taxing authority, like I said, the county, the library, the solid waste district, all the rest of them would receive extra revenue that would otherwise not be received because the tax caps were taking that away.
Would the property owners of Griffith save money? Would property taxes cost them less?
Yes. Anybody who is at the or below the tax cap would absolutely save. Those at the tax cap, there will be quite a few homes that would come under the cap, so they would realize some savings. As we get a little bit closer, when the 2020 bills come out, we'll know a little bit better exactly how many people will be at or above the tax caps that wouldn't be affected. But we think right now there's a pretty good sizable amount of taxpayers that will actually put the money right back in their pockets. Certainly anybody who owns a business is going to benefit greatly by this because the businesses are capped at 3% where the homes are capped at 1%.
That's Rick Reifa, who is the president of the Griffith Town Council, talking about the secession and now the bill that is before the legislature concerning Calumet Township secession, with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking. As we get into 2020, an organization which is called the Northwest Indiana Health Disparities Council is jumping right into discussion of the issues and the topics that are related to health care throughout Northwest Indiana. They're going to hold the very first community forum of the year on Friday. Tomorrow, it's going to happen at meeting as a breakfast session. It's going to happen at the Innsbrook Country Club on Taft Street in Merrillville. With us to talk about not only the Health Disparities Council, but the meeting coming up, we have Linda Hadley. She's the Marketing and Corporate Communications Director for Methodist Hospitals. Linda, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me on.
Will you please take some time to explain what the Northwest Indiana Health Disparities Council is all about, and how you are involved in such of these topics that is going to be many of them, I'm sure, coming up at the session on Friday morning?
Well, the Northwest Indiana Health Disparities Council is a group that has existed for probably a decade or more, and it was originated by a group of people, including Denise Dillard, who's the Methodist Hospital's chief of advocacy, and some other folks, to address the topics of the health disparities that exist in our society that create barriers to good health for minority populations. And they have a series of forums each year that focus on different topics, different health-related topics. One of the primary ones last year focused on infant mortality and what's being done to address the issue of higher rates of infant mortality in minority populations.
Now, I understand that the Health Disparities Council is made up of representatives of not only the hospitals here in Northwest Indiana, but other facets that are involved in healthcare too. You've got education, so you're talking about higher education, which means that you have IU Northwest involved because of the School of Medicine contacts they have.
That's for sure. It's the Health Disparities Council encompasses experts from a range of social service and health organizations across Northwest Indiana, including, those who are in the behavioral health world, folks from our food banks and Meals on Wheels. We have people from a wide variety of organizations, in addition to the region's representatives from the region's hospitals.
I know that the group has an opportunity and does so as part of, I guess, their mission, I suppose, when you think about it, to come up with some viable community health needs assessment. I think every hospital has to go through that. It's something that's set up in their makeup, I suppose, in a way. How does this particular session coming up here tomorrow, that's going to happen in Merrillville, will tie in together with certainly with what Methodist Hospital's plans are?
Well, every nonprofit hospital is required by the Affordable Care Act to conduct a community health needs assessment at least once every 3 years. And we're further required to use that data, to help us implement strategies for addressing the barriers to good health that exist in our communities. Typically, we collaborate. The Northwest Indiana hospital systems all collaborate on this, since our service areas, the populations we serve, are all overlapping. But this particular in this particular case, Methodist Hospitals is underwriting this meeting so that we can get input from the broader community for the programs that we will include in the Methodist Hospitals Community Health Needs Action Plan for the next 3 years. Mm-hmm. So the IRS and the Affordable Care Act also require us to seek input from not just community members themselves, but others in the region who have expertise and knowledge in public health and health issues. So that's why we've are going to the Health Disparities Council tomorrow morning to help get some input from all of those people on what they see in the constituents that they reach. What are the areas that we could all collaborate on with programs? Because Methodist Hospitals, as a standalone two hospital system, we cannot have impact, major impact on some of these community-wide issues. And so we seek partners to help us in the coming 3 years.
I think, yeah, obviously you talk about partners. You've got, you know, Franciscan Alliance, you've got community health systems, so, and mm-hmm. as well as with Methodist Hospital. So there are a lot of hands that have to be put together, I guess, to work some of these problems out. Did you folks do any survey work ahead of the meeting tomorrow to get some idea, or has a lot of this been planned out, sketched out over time, I would imagine? So.
The core of the community health needs assessment is a survey that is conducted amongst Lake County residents.
Mm-hmm.
And we have looked at, there's a wide variety of questions that are addressed in this survey, but the core ones ask people for their opinions on what are the top health concerns facing the residents of their communities, and what are the top concerns that should be priorities for resource allocation, and how important are various types of health and social service programs. And we use that data to help us determine the general overall areas of focus that we will be targeting in the next 3 years. And for Methodist, those three areas for the next 3 years are food and nutrition, specifically access and affordability and safety of the food supply that for our residents. Secondly is chronic diseases such as diabetes, COPD, and other lung diseases caused by smoking. Kidney disease, which has a high incidence in our communities, HIV, and diseases of aging and older adults. The third area we'll be focusing on over the next 3 years is child health and well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at, you know, daycare, infant and maternal mortality programs, that kind of thing. But for tomorrow, what we really want to be talking about with the broader community is how can we all partner for food and nutrition programs.
I understand that you've delved into the Methodist Hospital's family, literally family medicine family, to get your keynote speaker this year. Tell us what Dr. Mustafa Nakawa is going to talk about.
Dr. Nakawa is a Methodist Physician Group family physician who has come to us from a program in Massachusetts, run by Harvard,
mm-hmm.
that deals with health disparities. He's developed in his work as a family practice physician. He's become interested in treating obesity and lifestyle related diseases, and really his passion is to work with his patients and help them build healthy lifestyles. So he's very much interested in the role of health and nutrition, and that's what he's going to be talking about tomorrow.
Now, when you have a program like this, you have to plan ahead. You've got the Innsbruck Country Club people to work with to get the physical layout ready to go for this council. How far ahead have the partners in all of this and those people participating in tomorrow's breakfast had to be contacted to say, we're going to get together on January 17th,
yep.
and here's what we got to do. So how far ahead did you have to plan for
well,
this
one? Well, we've been working on this program since well before the holidays,
mm-hmm.
and are excited about having this be the kickoff meeting of the Health Disparities Council for 2020, and we hope then to be able to come back afterwards and say, here's some actual programs that have come out of this meeting and things that we can all work on together moving forward to improve our residents' access to healthy food.
Well, it sounds like that the Northwest Indiana Health Disparities Council has got a good community forum set up for tomorrow happening here in Merivale, and they've got a lot more plans after this one's finished up for more to come here in 2020. And we thank you very much, Linda, for talking about this and keeping us informed as to how the healthcare needs of Northwest Indiana are being met by all of the partners that are together on this. And we hope to have you back on to talk again about it real soon.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Linda Hadley is the Marketing and Corporate Communications Director for Methodist Hospitals, and she's talking about tomorrow's meeting at the Innsbruck Country Club in Merivale of the Northwest Indiana Health Disparities Council. It's going to be the very first community forum of 2020 to deal with the issues and topics that are related to Northwest Indiana healthcare. Continuing on with Regionally Speaking, let's turn to our reporters that we talk to on occasion. In fact, Joe Pete from the Times of Northwest Indiana, who covers business news all across the region, is with us to talk today. And as always, Joe, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Well, we've just talked with Linda Hadley with Methodist Hospitals about tomorrow's breakfast meeting of the Northwest Indiana Health Disparities Council. In fact, healthcare and the cost of healthcare is one of the major stories that you've had in the Times. Tell us about that and some of the issues that you discovered that you run into in putting together the story.
Yes, the Indiana Manufacturers Association recently did a statewide survey of what's on the mind of Indiana residents as the Indiana legislature convenes a new session to kind of offer them some guidance on, you know, maybe what their priorities ought to be. It found that one of the most pressing concerns that Hoosiers have this year is healthcare. About 55% listed affordable healthcare as one of their top issues that they're most concerned about. About a third have had like major unexpected bills that have just kind of come out of the blue, and so it's been it's been a major issue on the minds. So the people are also very concerned about jobs. About 55% were concerned with affordable health care, 50% with jobs, 46% with education, and 43% with cutting taxes. And then roughly about 20% thought that affordable health care ought to be the absolute top issue for state legislatures to look at.
When you talk about all of the issues involving health care, and I guess you've had some surveys and all to work with, I guess, and coming up with ways to find out what people's opinions are about their concerns and what is being done or needs to be done, where did you discover that the things happen to which direction do they have to go to, I guess, for Hoosiers to be able to get the kind of health care they need and what they can afford to have?
Oh, absolutely. With the survey, they also asked people kind of, you know, who they blame for these rising healthcare costs, and about 35% say they tend to blame hospitals, healthcare systems, and doctors. About 22% point to the insurance company premiums and the lack of good coverage or accessibility within the system. And only 2% of Hoosiers, which is probably within a statistical margin of error, said the system is fine and, you know, nothing needs to be done. More than a third, 35%, are blaming overcharges from hospitals and pretty much across the state. It's been because of particularly women and younger Hoosiers have had unexpected, or about 47% between 18 and 34 received like an unexpected bill out of the blue. And, you know, people were struggling to pay for that sort of thing. So it's been, you know, it's a pressing issue on their minds.
I know.
About half to have reported an increase in health insurance and out-of-pocket costs over the past year.
Do you see any similarity in some of the figures and the information that the IMA put together in the survey with what happens on a practical basis here in Northwest Indiana? Are residents here pretty much the same and like, and they're really, really worried about the cost of whatever they have to pay for their not only their medical care, but I guess for themselves, but for their family members too, huh?
Oh, it's been a pressing issue nationally, not just in Northwest Indiana. There's a lot of discussion of it during the, you know, the presidential campaign and presidential debates and everything, but it's clearly hits close to home locally, as the Indiana Manufacturers Association pointed out. They have a vested interest in this too, because they do represent manufacturers throughout the state, and one major issue for employers as well is, you know, keep holding down the cost of health insurance. It's been one of the, you know, biggest rising operating costs that they've faced, which is why in recent years they've been passing more and more of the burden on to their employees. You know, out-of-pocket costs have been going up. People have to, you know, higher premiums, higher deductibles. A lot of the health savings accounts, you know, they're trying to discourage people from seeking too much care and care they don't need by having the consumer kind of shoulder a lot more of the burden than they had traditionally.
One of the stories that you had out there in print and online on the business scene here in Northwest Indiana, and it's part of the series that you do on a regular basis, talking about the businesses that are open and closed, or either have been just opened up for their grand openings, or have had to make word to everybody that they will have to close for whatever reason. And one of the latest ones that you note here is an update that we all like to keep an eye on, which is pizza. and it's about Pizza Hut. Tell us first of how you got the information about how some of the Pizza Huts in Northwest Indiana are going to kind of change their clientele, maybe in a way, or certainly the way that they serve their clientele.
Oh, sure. Well, Pizza Hut is taking a new strategy nationally. They are planning to shutter about 500 of the restaurants over the next couple of years. They're shifting the focus from the traditional dine-in, sit-down restaurants with those distinctive roots that people know. There's this blog, used to be a Pizza Hut, where they identify, you know, buildings that were clearly former Pizza Huts, like that Subway on 45th in Highland, where it was, you know, you could just tell from the roof that that's what it used to be. But there's going to be a lot more of those on the landscape going forward, because they're trying to catch up to the rival Domino's, which has for years focused pretty much on, you know, the more of the takeout and, you know, the carryout and delivery model. Pizza Hut is kind of going in that direction, too. Their same-store sales have been falling for a while, and they're attributing a lot of that to their sit-down places. You know, once at one time used to be a fairly popular place to, you know, go after, like, a Little League game or something like that, but I think it's fallen off, and they're trying to place, you know, more of an emphasis on delivery, and the overhead is lower that way. They can goose sales that way. That's kind of the direction they're looking to go in. So what they're planning to do nationally is tear down a bunch of the older sit-down restaurants and replace them with more modern ones. In some cases, it'll be like express ones, like the ones you find in Target stores where they have a bunch of personal pan pizzas, just kind of hot and ready and waiting. And or there's that the combination Pizza Hut and Taco Bell at the truck stop in Burr Street and Gary, that it would be like that, but more of them will focus on, more of them are going to focus going forward on just the delivery and carry out. And that's their business strategy, and that they're pursuing all over. They're not commenting specifically on which, if any, ones that they're going to, but the most recent one they opened in Cedar Lake was only, there's no dine-in, it's entirely carry out and delivery. And, you know, that's what they're, you know, looking at going forward.
I would imagine in places like you say, like Cedar Lake, where you have is primarily a residential area, not a real big business area, but the businesses still want to be able to serve the residents at in the subdivisions all around, and all in particular the houses there along Lakeshore Drive in Cedar Lake. So I can see why they'd want to be able to set up, if they haven't already, to be able to set up some kind of a carry out and delivery option, to be sure. And do you think that maybe, who knows, I guess this is all up to Yum Brands, the people in Louisville that own the Pizza Huts and KFC and Taco Bell, I guess, as to how they're going to set up the combination to be able to sell the delivery and carryout ideas.
Yes, well, because I think there's generally a greater trend too nationally toward delivery. You see a host of competitors like Grubhub and Uber Eats, and all these companies are springing up, and they're kind of broadening the delivery market. It used to be, you know, the delivery was kind of limited to pizza and Chinese and just a couple of food segments. But now it's pretty much a lot of these tech company startups like, you know, Grubhub have basically transformed it to where almost any restaurant, you can get delivery from almost any restaurant kind of on demand. Even places like McDonald's and, you know, are offering it now. You know, it's broad and wide in the market beyond just the traditional, like a Jimmy John's or a Domino's or, you know, ones that are associated with delivery. And then, so I think they're, you know, customers are kind of becoming more acclimated toward convenience, you know, just getting something dropped off. You know, the age of e-commerce and online ordering has really made people used to the idea of just going on the computer, ordering something, and just having it show up at their doorstep, you know, whenever they want. And so I think Pizza Hut is kind of adjusting to that and to the, you know, changing consumer habits. Not that people are still going to go out and everything, but maybe the kind of pizza that Pizza Hut is offering isn't necessarily the, you know, the restaurants that people are going to go out for a special, you know, dine out experience. It's something you're going to order on like a Tuesday night, like, you know, when the Bulls are playing or whatever.
I would imagine, too, that we're seeing this, of course, it's nationwide, as you say, because the National Pizza Hut Organization is pressing the issue, wanting to be able to go up against the competition they face with not only with Domino's, but also with other pizza joints around, you know, Papa John's in particular, because a lot of the Papa John's, as you know, and if you no doubt know, in here in Northwest Indiana, are more like storefronts than anything else. They're sandwiched away in shopping areas, and they don't have, if anything, in fact, I don't think many of them even have sit-down capabilities in some of the restaurants. So they're just following the trend, I see. One other story that you have out there to check out in particular is a sad story, especially for folks that are always looking for interesting or maybe kitschy sort of things to put in their home. The Pier 1 import stores in Hobart and Valparaiso are among those around the country, I guess, that are going to close. Tell us what you found out here about our Northwest Indiana stores that are closing and I guess a few that are still staying open.
Yes, unfortunately, it's been a very challenging environment for retail stores. They've been calling it the retail apocalypse that, brick-and-mortar stores have been closing across the country. Online commerce still only accounts for about 11% of total retail sales, but, you know, that's 11% that's come out of the business of all these, you know, traditional brick-and-mortar stores people shop at, and they have much higher overhead, you know, at a store like Pier 1 than an online store like Warby Parker, where really all they need is, you know, warehouses and delivery trucks and that type of thing. They're not paying the utility bills. They're not paying, you know, as many employees. They just don't have the same overhead costs. And unfortunately, Pier 1 is the latest national retailer where they're going to look at shuttering stores. They're closing. They're rumored to be kind of going into potentially looking at bankruptcy and restructuring, but they announced during their most recent conference call that they're going to close 450 stores nationwide. They lost, I think, close to $60 million in the quarter and after a 13.3% drop in revenue. So they're just shrinking their footprint nationally. Two casualties of that will be the store by the South Lake Mall. It's in Merrillville Plaza in Hobart. It has a Merrillville address, but it's technically within the Hobart city limits. Mm-hmm. And then the Valparaiso store also will be, at the Valparaiso Marketplace, will be shutting down. We still will have, if anybody's a big fan of them and their imported furniture, imported home decor, home furnishings, and so forth, you still will be able to find it. The one at Chops on Main is staying in Cherville. Hopefully it's staying for the long term. Sometimes these decisions get affected by the leases that they're in and like how much time is left on them and that type of thing. So hopefully they're planning on keeping that store open and the sales are strong enough to continue. And it's not just a matter of like they just renewed the lease or something like that.
I know that particular store is a newer store because the Shops on Main is a newer complex there along Indianapolis Boulevard. So it's probably a good location. And I mentioned, too, that particular store gets a lot more, certainly, Illinois shoppers because it's closer to the state line.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the most bustling trade areas in the region. Yeah, anyone who's been in Westlake County recently, it's Illinois plates everywhere. You have a lot of South Suburban people come over here to shop, particularly to communities closer to the border like Cherville, specifically because income taxes here are lower. They can stretch their dollar a little bit further and save on their purchases. And then that's just been in one of the hotter retail areas like Cherville, St. John. You continue to see newer, you know, development there. And by all accounts, that mall is doing pretty well. Lifestyle Center, it opened only a couple years ago. But it's even when they've had casualties like the Gordon's closed because it was the chain went bankrupt, but they were able to quickly replace it with the exporting goods. They haven't had, you know, they've had a couple of businesses come and go, but any vacancies they've had have been filled like pretty quickly. So that indicates that area is pretty strong. The Highland Plaza Mall just north of there is, you know, continues to be a pretty popular attraction. Anybody who's tried to drive down the boulevard on a Saturday or Sunday just knows how, and, you know, sees all that traffic, just knows how, you know, how popular that area remains as a shopping destination.
Yeah, we're sitting here shaking our heads. We know we've got caught in that traffic on Indianapolis Boulevard there at Main Street. It's pretty rough here. Now, getting back to the closings that we have that have been announced already in Valparaiso and Hobart, any word as to when they're closing? Obviously, they're probably, if they haven't yet, going to be doing liquidation sales pretty soon.
Oh, yes. Both have started liquidation sales already. The Valparaiso location, they're slated to close on February 26th, and the employees of the Hobart store have not yet been told, at least at the time I did the story, had not yet been told exactly when they would be closing. Presumably, it'll be pretty soon. Sometimes these things drag out, like the Kmart in Valpo, as they were closing, that kind of ended up like going a little longer than they had initially anticipated. You know, it's just kind of, it's variable because usually they'll bring in, I don't think this isn't a bankruptcy, but sometimes they'll bring in a liquidation specialist and have them, manage the sale. But it depends on how quickly, they're able to get rid of their inventory. And so that can really determine how long they will stay open. But there is a hard date of February 26th for the Valpo location.
Whoa. And That's unfortunately the way it goes. And I was just thinking remember how the liquidation sale got dragged out for the Carson store when it closed at South Lake Mall? That was going to be a quick one, but it turned out more people wanted to catch the bargains as they possibly could. So that dragged out the closing of that store, to be sure. So, well, Joe, thank you very much for spending time giving us an update here on the stories that you put out there on the business scene in the Times recently, and hope to have you back on again real soon.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I look forward to it.
Joe Pete is a business reporter and writer for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And that's it for Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks to Joe Pete with the Times of Northwest Indiana, to Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson, and to Michael Puente with Chicago Public Radio in the conversations, as well as you, our listeners, for joining us. We'll be back with you on Monday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.